Rouhani, Chief Executive of ISIS. This is Hazrat Abedin, Excellencies, distinguished guests, friends. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Peace be with you. I'd like to begin by thanking ISIS for this kind invitation. We've been asked to speak on the Lotus Revolution, the dynamics of political change in Egypt and beyond. I shall divide my presentation into three segments. First, I shall deal with Egypt and the post-uprising scenario in Egypt. Number two, I shall look at some of the other Arab countries in relation to Egypt and the possible changes that may take place and the challenges that they face. And number three, I shall look at Libya, which I think is a special case. Let me begin with Egypt. What is perhaps easily predictable? Within the next 6 months, we can expect to see the emergence of a constitution, which would have the support, it seems to me, of a broad cross-section of Egyptian society. It would be a constitution which, from what we have been hearing, would look at the electoral system, the structure of power, other elements of governance. It would perhaps also include a feature which a number of civil society groups in Egypt have been asking for, a sort of limitation on the period of the presidency, the tenure of the president, among other changes. These may be incorporated into a constitution which would be positive by and large. Number two, one can also expect preparations for an election within 6 months, which is what the people have been promised. By September, perhaps, an election. An election which should be fairer than anything Egypt has seen in its entire history, in terms of participation, in terms of its fairness, and I suppose some of the other attributes of an election which the Egyptians could be proud of. Now that's as far as what seems possible at this stage. But there are, I think, certain fundamental issues which still remain very unclear. And I shall raise five issues in relation to Egypt. Number one, to what extent will the post-uprising scenario accommodate the status quo? It's unclear. In other words, the status quo attempting to perpetuate itself, which one should expect to happen. In other words, elements within the existing power structure trying to ensure that their interests are perpetuated. Because there are deeply entrenched interests in Egyptian society, which will not give up without a fight. In other words, Hosni Mubarak may not be around, but the Mubarak syndrome is still alive, and some of those elements will try to perpetuate themselves. So I think this is something which we have to look at, why and how this is going to happen. Number two, an equally important question related to the first, what will be the role of the military after the new constitution and elections? Because there is no guarantee that once you hold elections in Egypt, the military will confine itself to the barracks. Why? Because the military has been a major actor in Egyptian politics for a very long while. The Officers' Revolution of 1952 was led by a military officer, Colonel Najib. After him was Gamal Nasser, the two of them were actually together in the initial period, but Nasser became more important a little later. And then you had Anwar Sadat, also from the military, Mubarak from the military. The military has been a major force in Egyptian politics, and it's just not going to confine itself to the barracks. I mean, this is something that we have to understand. The relationship between the military and a civilian government, a democratically elected government, what would be the relationship? This is something we are not certain about. I raise this question about the military also because the military has got extensive economic interests. It has investments within Egyptian society. In almost every major sector, there are investments from the military, not unlike Indonesia, not unlike Myanmar, not unlike a number of other societies where the military has been very, very prominent. And also, the military has got extensive ties with external actors, with the United States, which apart from training Egypt's military, has also had very close ties in relation to corporations, for instance. Major military contractors in the United States of America have close relations with the Egyptian military. So what would be the role of the military in a post-elections Egypt, in an Egypt that is moving towards democracy? Second question. Third question. What would be the role of Muslim or Islamic political forces? I don't want to see this merely in relation to what we call the Muslim men, the Muslim Brotherhood. It's more than that. What would be the role of Islam in politics in the near future? This is a very big question. You can be absolutely certain that Islam will have a role in Egyptian politics. In fact, Islam has always been important in Egyptian politics. When people talk about Islam and politics after Mubarak and so on, we forget that Islam has always been significant in Egyptian politics. Don't forget that some of the major reform movements in the Arab world have actually originated in Egypt. Some of the greatest reformers are also Egyptians, if you look at the history of Islam and politics in the Arab world. So Islam is going to be important, but what form it will take, how it will express itself, we're not very certain. Will it be an Islam that's related to the Sharia? In other words, a certain notion of the Islamic State and Islamic rules, regulations, laws, very much the sort of ideology which the Ikhwanul Muslimin pushed in an earlier period. The Ikhwanul Muslimin today has, I think, moved away from that sort of thinking in certain respects. And there are new dimensions that have emerged within the Ikhwanul Muslimin over the last so many decades, partly because the Ikhwanul Muslimin was pushed out of politics. And for that reason, because it was banned for a very long while, since 1954, I think, because it was banned for such a long while, the Ikhwanul Muslimin developed a very strong educational and welfare orientation, which has influenced and shaped its approach towards Islam. Now, how will that express itself in democratic Egypt? A very big question mark. Another way of posing this question is, are we going to see, given Egypt's long relationship with Islamic reform, are we going to see the emergence of an approach to Islam which is more values-centered rather than hudud or sharia-oriented? Are we going to see that? In other words, a values-oriented approach towards Islam. We don't know. We don't know. This is something that may happen. Now, yet another very important question that we have to look at, a fourth question. Will a democratic Egypt, democratic in the electoral sense, meaning by which you have parties, elections, and all the rest of it, will a democratic Egypt address some of the fundamental economic issues which have challenged the people of Egypt and people in other parts of the Arab world? Let's not forget that at the root of the revolt that we witnessed in Egypt were issues like food prices, serious unemployment, massive unemployment, a growing gap between rich and poor. And these are challenges which repeat themselves, replicate themselves all over the Arab world. And if I may add, these are challenges which you find in many other parts of the world today. The challenge, for instance, of unemployment, which is also very much part of the northern economy, not just the southern economies. You have got growth without jobs, which is a new phenomenon in economic history. And we have to ask some searching questions. Why are these things happening? Why is it that in the case of Egypt, an Egypt that was self-sufficient in food, had a self-reliant economy in the 50s and 60s, an economy which my friend, the late Abdul Wahab al-Masiri, described as the economy of dignity in the earlier period. And then, of course, Egypt opened up to the world, as it were. Privatization on a massive scale, deregulation, liberalization, in other words, embracing the conventional wisdom that this is the way to go. And as a result of that, massive unemployment, increasing, escalating food prices, and a growing gap between rich and poor. I think the time has come, not just for people in Egypt, but people elsewhere, including this country, to ask searching questions about the wisdom of certain economic theories and models of development. Do they serve the larger interests of humankind as a whole, the poor in particular? This is a fundamental question. Will a democratic Egypt of the future address these issues? Or are some of the people who are trying to manage and manipulate change in Egypt, are they going to ensure that none of these issues are raised? In other words, keep Egypt as it is, as far as its economy is concerned, have elections, which will be an example of cosmetic changes, don't deal with root problems of this sort. Is this what is going to happen? This, I think, is another major question. And the fifth and final question, the elephant in the living room that has not been addressed in a lot of the commentaries about what's happening in Egypt and the Arab world, the question of Israel. How would a democratic Egypt deal with the question of Israel? The so-called peace treaty of 1979, a treaty that has been described lightly as a cold treaty, because it's a treaty that has not led to anything. There is no relationship between the Egyptian people and the Israeli people. It's just a treaty in name, a treaty that a lot of Egyptians had opposed at that time, and of course, you know, Anwar Sadat was assassinated largely because of the peace treaty. Now, what's going to happen to that peace treaty, and what would be the relationship between Israel and a democratic Egypt? An Egypt where the leaders have to account to the people, not an Egypt that is led by an elite that is totally unaccountable, where popular sentiments count, where aspirations of the people count. Here, we have to ask ourselves, the military, which is part of this transition, when it decided to allow two Iranian warships to pass through the Suez to Syria just last week. What was the signal that they were sending to Israel? What was the signal that they were sending to the dissidents and the protesters? It is an important decision, a very important decision, because since 1979, since the Iranian revolution, no Iranian warships have been allowed to pass through the Suez. And these ships have gone to Syria. So what does this indicate? And as you know, some of the leaders in Egypt today, those who are helping to shape the new constitution, and a couple of them are very well respected individuals, they have said that one has to review the treaty with Israel. So what would be the scenario after this? Israel, United States of America, in relation to a democratic Egypt. Now these are five questions, friends, in relation to Egypt. I'd like to suggest that all of these questions are also relevant in relation to Tunisia. Tunisia and what has happened in Tunisia bear a lot of similarities, parallels to the Egyptian situation. All the five questions. If you look at the question about the status quo and how it can perpetuate itself, the military, because the military was also important in Tunisia. In fact, it was the defiance of the Tunisian general, the overall commander of the Tunisian forces, in relation to the president, the former president Ben Ali, which saved the demonstrators. He refused to shoot upon the demonstrators. So the military is going to be important. The whole question of Islam is very important in Tunisia, because the major political party is the Nahda party, the Renaissance movement in Egypt, led by an outstanding Islamic scholar Rashid Ghannouchi, what would be their role in Tunisia? That's a very important question. And again, the other questions about the economy, because again, Tunisia, almost the same problems, unemployment, crisis, growing gap between rich and poor, we have to address this. And the question of Israel, perhaps not as important as in Egypt, but nonetheless also critical for Tunisia. But let me suggest, friends, that if you look at some of the other countries, there are things that are very unique to each of them, apart from these five questions that make the situation more complicated. Let me talk again of five such unique circumstances in the different countries in the Arab world that are facing popular revolts at the moment. First, a very important question that affects a number of the monarchies, specific and unique to the monarchies. Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Oman, Bahrain, Kuwait, all these monarchies, not one of them is a constitutional monarchy in the real sense of the word. Some are more constitutional and less absolute than others, but all of them are not genuine constitutional monarchies, not even Kuwait, not Jordan, and certainly not Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Oman, and so on. And this is a major question that challenges the Arab world. Can absolute monarchies in the Arab world become genuine constitutional monarchies? Absolute monarchies, can they become genuine constitutional monarchies? Very important as far as democracy is concerned. You cannot have an absolute monarchy and a democracy at the same time. It is a contradiction in terms. You have to transform. And it's very significant that just 3 days ago, a group of intellectuals, professionals, and religious leaders in Saudi Arabia submitted a memorandum to the king where they demanded a genuine constitutional monarchy. Elections, a redefinition of powers, of authority, change in the relationship between leader and led, but all these things have to change. And this, I think, is a genuine aspiration of a lot of countries in the Arab world, the countries which we describe as monarchies. How will they evolve? What will happen? We don't know. But this, I think, is one of the areas we have to look at. Unique to the absolute monarchies in the Arab world. Number two, again, something very unique that affects one particular country in the Arab world. This is the challenge of sectarianism and how sectarianism impacts upon democracy, and the country that one is talking about is Bahrain. 70% of the population, about 550,000 people in Bahrain, 70% of the population is Shia. The leadership is Sunni. The leadership is an entrenched monarchy. The Prime Minister is the uncle of the king, and he has been there for quite a long while, the Prime Minister. The Shia population, there is also a problem of poverty, of neglect, of marginalization, wage of unhappiness. But what is critical is, this is the majority, 70% of the population, and they're demanding rights in a country that is not really poor. They're demanding their dignity. This is a major issue. How will this resolve itself? So it's not just like the other countries with economic issues and issues of the military and so on. Here you have the question of sectarianism. Why? Because the majority has marginalized, and the majority come from a sect that is different from the minority that is in power. A third dimension to this uniqueness that you find in some of those countries, and this involves Yemen. The third dimension involves Yemen. And what is the challenge in Yemen? In Yemen, apart from all those things that we have talked about, the challenge here is the threat of secession, of the country breaking up. Let's not forget that North and South Yemen were put together in 1990, just about 20 years ago. The divisions and dichotomies are very serious between the North and the South. And again, if you look at the situation, the majority of those who are poor, the unemployed, the youth who are rebelling, largely from the South, in what we are seeing on television and so on, lots of them are from the South. And now the whole question of sectarianism has come to the fore again. were not happy with the president who was from the north, and who was again deeply entrenched. And if you look at the geopolitics of the region, Aden is in the south. Aden is very critical to U.S. imperial power in that part of the world, and they want to maintain their grip. So the whole question of sectarianism has got geopolitical implications. What's going to happen? Will Yemen break up again? This is a big question that's been asked as a result of the democratic revolt, as a result of people demanding their rights. Can that happen? So that's yet another dimension, a fourth dimension. A country where demonstrations are taking place, but somehow the demonstrations did not lead to a sort of massive mobilization of people that are taking place in some of the other Arab countries. And the country that I have in mind, this is my fourth dimension, is Algeria. Why is it that in Algeria we don't have this sort of mass popular action against the elite, even though it started but somehow it didn't catch on? Commentators have given a number of reasons, but among them two very important reasons which are worth reflecting upon. The Algerian elite, which includes the military, is very cohesive. It's an integrated, cohesive elite. And it is very much on top of the situation, partly because of its internal cohesiveness. But there is also the memory of the terrible civil war that they've gone through, where, you know, the banning of the Islamic Salvation Front in 1992, and all that had happened after that, the sufferings that the people had gone through, tens of thousands of people killed. They don't want instability. They don't want chaos in their country. So this apparently is also yet another reason. But whether it will hold, whether this sort of situation can perpetuate itself, we don't know, because unemployment is a serious problem in Algeria too, like in some of the other Arab countries. So we don't know how the situation will unfold in the future. This brings me to the fifth and the last example, unique in the Arab world, the situation in Syria. Why is it that in Syria there has been no mass demonstrations? Syria in some ways would be like some of the other Arab countries. One-party dominance. You don't have multi-party competition as such in Syria. There's the problem of unemployment in Syria. You also have the problem of inflation in Syria. That's not as serious as some of the other countries. And yet, Syria is in a different category. You don't have these mass demonstrations and so on. I'd like to suggest perhaps four reasons why Syria appears to have handled the situation differently. Number one, when Bashar Assad took over from his father in 2000, he introduced reforms. In other words, he had the foresight to introduce reforms from the outset. Political reforms in terms of opening up the system to some extent, economic reforms, cultural reforms, he started moving in the direction. And he also addressed the question of Islam. Bashar Assad. Within the secular framework, he introduced a progressive approach to Islam, which took into account popular sentiments about Islam, but tried to situate Islam within an ethos which was universal, inclusive, accommodative. And that, I think, succeeded in winning him quite a bit of support, because Syria itself is, as you know, a society that is multi-religious. It has got different religious sects and communities and so on. So that was a clever approach. Now, apart from that, it is also significant, if you look at what has been happening in Syria, that the bond between leader and led in Syria is in some respects unique. You have a leadership that is very close to the people. And when these protests were taking place in other Arab countries, if you look at the social media network in relation to Syria, they were saying that they have a different sort of president, younger than many of them, relates very easily to young people in Syria, able to understand their aspirations, a person who has the pulse, who has still on the pulse of the nation. And this, I think, has also helped, the bond between leader and led. And the final factor, I think, is this, that Syria, unlike almost every other Arab country, has been clear, firm on the question of Israel. No flip-flop, no lies to the people. The WikiLeaks, in a sense, vindicated the Syrian leadership, because what they told the ambassadors and others in private conversations was exactly what they've been telling their own people. No lies, no playing games with their people. So that integrity of the Syrian leadership has been a positive factor. Friends, now this brings me to the last part of my presentation. Having looked at some of these examples in other countries I haven't talked about, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and there must be explanations for their situation. I won't go into that. I want to deal now with Libya. Libya is a special case. In Libya, we have, to all intents and purposes, a full-scale civil war. We didn't have a civil war in Egypt. There was no civil war as such in Tunisia. A civil war may break out in Yemen. It's possible. But in the case of Libya, there is already a civil war. In other words, you have people who support the existing government and the people who are opposed to it. Now, why something unique has happened in Libya is worthy of analysis and explanation. How is it that Benghazi has been able to establish an autonomous authority? It is not broken away from Libya, but it is autonomous to all intents and purposes. I think there are a variety of reasons, some of which are linked to the Gaddafi leadership itself. What are the reasons? Number one, you have to look at Benghazi historically. Benghazi, in terms of its history, was from the middle of the 19th century a region that was administered directly from the capital of the Ottoman Empire. It had quite a lot of autonomy, even in the past, and that I think is a very significant point. In other words, Benghazi had its own character, and that historical ethos explains some of what is happening in Benghazi. Apart from that, if you look at the Gaddafi leadership, one of the weaknesses, if you like, from the point of view of governance of the Gaddafi leadership was this, that he did not and made no attempt at all to create effective institutions of governance. It was just a mess. It was a total mess. There are a number of people, I'm sure, who have been to Libya, and I remember when my wife and I went to Libya in 1980, and that was just 11 years after Gaddafi's revolution of 1969. The one thing that struck us was how chaotic Libya was. Totally chaotic. And a friend of mine I was talking to yesterday, who went there in 1995, he said if it was chaotic in 1980, it was worse in 1995. Totally chaotic. No structure, institutions, nothing. A very personalized, autocratic type of leadership, which is one of the reasons why Benghazi, which is 1,200 kilometers from Tripoli, where Benghazi has been able to exert its authority. And don't forget that Benghazi is also associated with perhaps the greatest Libyan freedom fighter in modern times, Umar Mokhtar. His resistance was actually from Benghazi, the resistance of Umar Mokhtar. So this is the Benghazi tradition. And now that they are free, they call themselves free Libya, there's no way they will be subdued. There's no way they will be brought under the control of Gaddafi again. So what this suggests is you've got a full-blown civil war situation in Libya. And how it's going to unfold, no one knows. One hopes that Gaddafi, in the interest of people, will quit. This is what one hopes for. One hopes that his inner circle will persuade him to quit. One hopes that his very close friends in the international arena will tell him, look, this is in the best interest of Libya. Because if he don't quit, if Gaddafi doesn't quit, there is a strong possibility that there would be military intervention. Even though at the moment they say, well, it's not on the table, this morning's news, over Al Jazeera that they're not thinking of military intervention, but you can never know. The U.S. warships are there. There are people pushing for this. The U.S. right-wing, people like Joseph Lieberman, John McCain, Paul Wolfowitz, Elliot Abrahams. In fact, 40 of them have signed an open letter asking for military intervention. And we know why they want to do it. Not because they want to save Libyan lives. They want to do it for the reasons why the U.S. is doing the Arab world for such a long while. It's for strategic reasons. It's the most strategic region of the world, the Mediterranean and the region around it. But it's also because of oil. It's because of Israel. It is to secure these key triple interests of U.S. and British imperialism. They want to get in, gain control, determine the future of that region. Don't forget that Libya has the biggest oil reserves in the whole of Africa. The biggest oil reserves, 46.3 billion barrels. And it is the third biggest in terms of natural gas in the whole of Africa. And they say, according to market analysts, only 60% of oil has been exploited in Libya. Which means in a situation of peak oil, you know, all of the prognosis that we've been reading about peak oil and so on, Libya would be a goldmine for people who want to gain control of Libya. And this is why I think the situation is quite dangerous. One hopes that it doesn't evolve this way. One hopes that if the situation becomes really bad and there's a need for some sort of intervention to save innocent people in this civil war scenario, it will have to be the UN. The blue helmets, the UN should be involved, not the US, not NATO. And if you're thinking of troops, it must be drawn from Asia, from Latin America perhaps, as part of a UN peace enforcement force, but not from the European countries and not from the United States of America. Thank you very much.